It's a great pleasure to have Tashi here with us today. I'm always delighted when I see people come to the West from the East, and particularly when they come out of a Tibetan monastery. My first exposure to this was the exposure to the Maharishi and to meditation. And I remember the Maharishi and I were on the same television program. I mean, this is way back in the early 60s. And the Maharishi, as you know, is minute like that. And I was looking down at the Maharishi and saying, it's a really great pleasure to be here with you. And he was looking up at me and saying, yes, I think so. And then we had one of these confrontations, except it must have been rather disappointing for the producers because I didn't enter into it, and we talked about meditation and its benefits. And it's amazing how since then meditation has spread out. I remember myself and Wallace were two of the first workers on meditation, and I was at the National Hospital at that time, and everybody said, why on earth do you want to do that? What's the point of looking at meditation? It's only just people imagining things. And it was quite clear from the neuroscience of it as it was beginning then that it wasn't just imagination. Now, you all know about London taxi drivers. We've heard them mentioned once. I'm going to mention them again. You all know that they have huge brains on the right-hand side of their brain. In their temporal lobes, the areas which code for spatial location. If I can't see, oh, there's Ian. Is it holistic spatial location? And so there's no doubt at all that a function is often reflected in changes in cerebral structure. And the question really for us is, does meditation change cerebral structure? Well, there are two really interesting papers which have come out recently which show that those people who are meditators have larger brains, well, not larger brains everywhere, but in the frontal cortex, in the medial orbital part of the frontal cortex. And the interesting point about that is that this area mediates fear resolution. And so what you can do is, I can look around here, you see, and I can say, enlarged frontal cortex, enlarged frontal cortex, enlarged frontal cortex. And I know that you're all going to be wonderfully calm with this ability to mediate your fear responses. And the second point, the second studies, was the interconnectedness of the brain that meditators seem to show. So there are then changes in structure, and there's another paper being published which shows that the size of the brain is dependent, the size of that area is dependent on the years you spend meditating. So there's a nice correlation between it. So it's a great pleasure to have Tashi here today. Tashi told me, and it's in his bio, that he went into a Tibetan monastery at the age of 13. And I thought, wow, tough thing to do. And he said, oh, no, it's not like you think. In the monastery, you don't sit there cross-legged meditating all day. You interact with all the other students there. It's debates. It's discussions. It's a very lively thing to be in the Tibetan monastery. And so I got the sort of feeling it was rather like going to an English public school rather than going to this ideal monastery. And I asked Tashi if he could remember just something really important, his most memorable experience. I felt rather like one of these programs. Tell me, what's your most memorable experience? And he gave me a lovely story. When he was 17, apparently at 16, 17, you are allowed for the first time to go into the kitchens and help with the cooking. And he had to take some tea to the more senior monks, and apparently about 700 of them in the monastery. And he went there with his mates of the same age. And I don't know, he didn't tell me who was the one who decided it, but they decided that they would uncouple the thongs in the monk's shoes and then recouple them again. Now, just imagine, 700 monks, endless, what, 1,400 pairs of sandals, all uncoupled and decoupled. And when their meditation session was over, absolute chaos broke loose in the monastery. So clearly, being in a Tibetan monastery is great fun. So Tashi, it really is such a pleasure to have you here. And you've kindly given us the title, The Spirit of Compassion in Tibetan Buddhism. I'd ask you all to welcome him.
Thank you, Peter. Usually I don't take any notes. As Karen Armstrong, she said, you know, when you prepare, your talk won't go as you prepared. So it's same to me. I don't take any notes. But yesterday evening I thought I must take some notes what I'm going to say. So first I will say just one short verse, which is the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, when we, do this kind of gathering, to start with a short salutation verse. So I will say that verse. And that verse is written by a great Indian master in 5th century. AD, called Chandrakirti, a great, great Indian Buddhist master, scholar, as well as practitioner. And he wrote several books. And one of his books started with this verse, paying homage to the compassion. So I thought it is because of our subject that I'm going to talk. I think it's quite relevant me to start my talk saying that verse in Tibetan. Kanji zhenye gyewe lo do pinzo de sabi dhani pen la chura yurin longzhe ne la minpa tabo de gyoba techir dhanke tongma nyingje de bara ye. First, I feel extremely great honor and humble to given this opportunity, to follow those great previous speakers, and feel very humble be here with you, and to talk, on the subject. The spirit of compassion in Tibetan Buddhism. The verse just I have said, from this great Indian master text, saying the compassion is similar to the seed, water, and the fruit. To a farmer to get a right good crops. At the beginning, need very, you know, what's called good seeds. At the middle, need great good water. And at the end, to ripen the crops. When those three happens, the farmer will be extremely happy. Similar to that, the compassion is important at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end. Individually, as well as collectively. Individually, at the beginning, you know, whether we have spiritual life or not, compassion is extremely important. At the middle, while we are growing up, compassion is important for our life to be very productive. At the end, when our life starting to, you know, slow down, compassion is extremely important to experience. So this verse saying the compassion is like the, you know, the, as an example given, saying seed, water, and the ripen crops. Like that, it is extremely important for us at the beginning, at the middle, at the end. And particularly if we have a spiritual life, then compassion is the key factor to at the beginning to start your spirituality, at the middle to nurture your spiritual life, at the end, you know, to experience fulfillment of your spiritual life. So this verse, which written by this great Indian master at the beginning of his amazing text, saying, I pay homage to the great compassion because of, you know, the importance at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end. Now, to define what is compassion is not easy. You know, it's not that easy. Although we use the term, you know, in English, say compassion, in Sanskrit, say karuna, in Tibetan, to say nyingje. But to define exactly what kind of mind that compassion is not that easy. Now, first, I want to, you know, before I go in that level, I want to start, say this. All of us have degrees of, you know, the potential be able to feel empathy, be able to, you know, feel concern when other living creatures having difficulties. And that is there naturally, that potential or that seed, whatever you call it, that be able to, you know, feel sense of concern when we see, you know, other living creatures having difficulties. In Buddhism, some Buddhist philosophical schools, that seed, that potential is the seed that, you know, if you nurture properly, correctly, may turn, you know, turn into fully awakened mind that naturally, happening that kind of ability, be able to feel concern when we see the difficulties that other living beings, living creatures are experiencing. But it is just form of seed, form of potential. And that kind of potential is not only the people who have a spiritual path. All human beings have the same, that seed, that potential. No differences whatsoever as far as that level is concerned. Then, for many centuries, different, the religious traditions, different philosophers use that as foundation to launch the means and the methods, how to enhance, how to promote that seed, how to bring that seed into reality. Judaism, Christianity, Islam in the West, and in the East, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism. If we look at, that is the main sort of what you call the base. Then use the different, philosophies, different views, different methods, different, the means to, how to enhance that seed, how to bring that seed more into active role in our day-to-day lives, in our everyday lives. At that level, I think all the major, spiritual traditions have contributed tremendously, in our humanity to enhance that, to bring that compassion into more active role in our everyday lives. The Abrahamic religious tradition, Judaism, Christianity, and the Islam, who believe Creator, God. Buddhism does not believe Creator, God, but still, at that level, all the world major religious traditions, use that, from the different angles to use that, how to enhance that seed. Now, my area is Tibetan Buddhism, so the second sort of like a background I want to say a few words is this. When it comes to, Buddhism, or I usually use the term Buddha Dharma instead of Buddhism, that ism, I'm not really happy with that that term, but also there's nothing I can do it. So the Buddha Dharma, as there are two major traditions, Theravadin and the Mahayana. So the area where I am, familiar with is the second one, the Mahayana tradition. So I'm going to talk from that tradition's viewpoint, how, compassion, is enhanced, cultivated further, through the Mahayana Buddhist teachings and practices. Let me see whether I'm following my note or not. in general, in Buddha Dharma, when the historical Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, a place called Bodhgaya, he taught his first teaching after 49 days after his enlightenment at a place called Varanasi, and there's a small town called Sarnath. And his first teaching is called the Four Noble Truths. And out of Four Noble Truths, I want to touch briefly with the first two Noble Truths, because there is a connection with the cultivation of compassion. So out of Four Noble Truths, the first two Noble Truths that he taught are the Noble Truth of suffering, or people don't like using the term suffering, or say Noble Truth of dukkha, because, you know, that this Sanskrit term dukkha, some of the Western scholars, you know, they say, you know, the English term suffering that cannot capture the full meaning of that Sanskrit, you know, term dukkha. But I usually use just say suffering. So dukkha, the first noble truth of suffering. The second noble truth is noble truth of origins of suffering. So in other words, suffering and the way the suffering comes from, the origins of suffering. When Buddha taught these two first two noble truths, relation to the first noble truth, Buddha said, you know, should be fully understood. The noble truth of suffering, the dukkha, should be fully understood. And that is really something very much relevant to cultivation, enhancement of compassion. To cultivate, to enhance the compassion, the seed that we have, we need to understand, not just intellectually, from our heart level, we need to understand the dukkha. Not just the surface dukkha, which we all, even the certain levels, even the animal will understand as a dukkha, but more, you know, the subtle level, which we all share, which we all experience. Buddha said, that is something very, very important. You know, the dukkha, to understand there is a dukkha, each and every, you know, within us, there is a dukkha. And that dukkha should be fully understood, not in the surface, not in a certain level, but fully, completely. Then the origins of dukkha, where the dukkha comes from, Buddha said, you know, should be abandoned. Why I'm saying that? The reason is this. The surface dukkha, you know, the surface difficulties, the office difficulties, you know, are different from country to country, from culture to culture, you know, within the one society, different. For example, you know, but more deeper level, the dukkha is shared by every living creature. No difference. When we start to understand that levels of dukkha, then cultivating compassion to every living creature will be easier. So that's why Buddha, said the dukkha should be fully understood. Now, when Buddha taught these first two noble truths of dukkha and the origins of dukkha, initially he explained that relation to oneself. And that is something extremely important. If we do not understand one's own dukkha and the origins of dukkha, then it is very, very difficult to understand other living creatures' dukkha and the origins of dukkha. As earlier, the speakers mentioned several times, saying, we need to learn first, be compassionate to ourselves, then expand that to be compassionate to others. And it is exactly the same. So that therefore, before we start to, understand the dukkha of other living creatures, first we need to understand the dukkha upon ourselves. Quite often, when I talk on this subject, particularly in the West, there are complaints saying, we didn't come here to listen to suffering, dukkha. We come here to enjoy. I totally agree with that. But because the nature of our subject, to talk about compassion, if we don't talk about dukkha, then it's very shallow, the conversation. So that's why I'm repeating again and again that. Now, the cultivation of compassion in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition particularly in the certain Buddhist scholars and the practitioners, very systematically structured the methods, how to enhance that compassion. How to enhance the compassion. So the structure goes like this. Of course, as I just briefly touched, saying first the dukkha and the origins of the dukkha, should be fully understood in relation to one's own life. Then the next step, the second step, is what we call, what that particular, that Indian, another great Indian scholar, 7th century, the AD, Shantideva, a great, great Indian master. He wrote several books, and one of his very classical, the book is called Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And in that text, there are 10 chapters, and the 8th chapter, starting from verse 89, I think, there's a very systematically structured how to enhance that compassion. And the first step is called equalizing oneself with others. That's the first step, equalizing oneself with others. What does that mean? It means really from your heart, from our heart, to understand, to feel oneself and others are equal. equal in the sense of fundamentally, you know, that I want happiness, so do you. I do not want unhappiness, neither you. From that level, no differences whatsoever. That kind of yearning that I have, and the yearning that you have, no differences. Although in the surface, what kind of happiness I want and what kind of difficulties I do not want may be different from you. Although I lived in, you know, the West now almost 18, 19 years, I still don't like lying down on the beach, you know, torturing myself in the sun. I still haven't learned that. You know, as soon as I go, you know, to beach with somebody, I want to cover my head and, you know, but my friends will love doing that. Hours, they will, you know, they will lay down. They get pleasure, I get pain. But that is the culture. That's because of the culture. That's because of the how we brought up. I'm sure many of you, you know, dislike Tibetan tea. I like Tibetan tea. But, you know, the many Westerners says Tibetan tea is not really tea. It's like a soup. It's salty, buttery, milky, you know. But I like. But that's why I like, because I'm brought up in that culture. Definitely in the surface, there are differences. What I want, what you want, you know, so on and so forth. But at the fundamental level, we all have the same yearning. That is extremely important, that to acknowledge that. Initially to acknowledge that. They also have that yearning, which I have. That acknowledgement will bring that feeling of equal, myself and others. Maybe have a different hair colors, different skin colors, different culture, but at the heart level is same and equal. And also have the same right. Nobody has more right to be happy, be free from suffering than the others. Nobody. We all have the same right. I'm not talking about this from, you know, the politically. I'm talking about, you know, the from basic, you know, the our what we are. And that's called equanimity. You know, the equanimity that myself and others are equal. Without cultivating that experience, that understanding, that knowledge, that acknowledgement, that acceptance, myself and others are equal. Very, very difficult to cultivate genuine compassion. Very, very difficult. That is the really certain extent, the foundation that, you know, our the seed to grow, that naturally, you know, happening, occur within us, that, you know, the seed or that potential that we have to grow, that is the foundation. Now, to cultivate or to genuinely from the heart level, not the head level, from the heart level, to really to feel that kind of, you know, the equanimity, then the meditation is extremely important. Meditation. Of course, initially, information, why, how, so on and so forth, now, to get the understanding. But to really go into heart level, that kind of understanding, then the meditation. In Buddhism, there's another sequence saying listening, contemplation, and meditation. Listening in the sense of first to gather the information, the right information, the correct information. In this case, you know, the right, correct information of, you know, the equanimity. We are equal from the many different sources. Then the information that we gathered, then contemplate. Now here, contemplation is not simply just to think. Contemplation in the sense of rigorous analysis on the information that we have got. Not to take it at a face value, but really, you know, very rigorously analyze, examine the information that we have got. And through that, we'll reach to the conclusion. And on the conclusion, then, what we do is the third level, is the meditation. Quite often in the Buddhist teachings called wisdom. Wisdom gained through listening, wisdom gained through contemplation, and wisdom gained through meditation. All those three levels, three stages, will gain wisdom, but the most important wisdom is at the third level, through the meditation. Meditation here, it means, you know, at the second level, with the contemplation, in this case, analysis, examination, you know, the conclusion that we have gained, then bring that conclusion within ourselves again and again and again and again. And there's here the meditation. So, to feel compassion, in this case, this level I'm talking about, you know, the equanimity from our heart level, very genuine, very sincere, very honest, very open, you know, not some kind of pretending, you know, to have that level, that kind of, you know, the experience, then what we need to do, bring that understanding into our mind again and again and again. And that is here simply what the term is used, meditation. You know, bringing the conclusion into our mind again and again. You know, this morning and yesterday evening, we have, you know, we listened amazing talks, and you know, I've heard many sounds of agreement. You know, the points what the speakers raised. Those, if you agree what the speakers have said, that agreement is mainly at our heart level, head level. But to bring into heart level is important. How to bring in that what we have agreed, what speakers have said to into our heart level need to bring into our mind again and again and again. If we do that, then it will become what we call very spontaneous, very natural, effortless. So that, which is some quite important to say. Then the second stage, after the equanimity is experienced, equanimity oneself with others, then the next step is called exchanging oneself with others. Exchanging oneself with others. Exchanging oneself with others, it doesn't mean oneself become others, others become oneself. Not in that sense. But it is in the mental level. Up to now, you know, our activities, our thoughts, our plans, our, you know, whatever, most of them are really very much related, associated with oneself, me, I. Change that. Not to me or I, say others. The plans that we make, the activities that we do to bring, say, to others. So that is here again at this stage is more at the mental level. I totally agree, you know, that it is important compassion to bring into action. But action to become real, you know, right action, compassionate action, if we haven't transformed our attitudes, our mental states, quite often our action goes wrong. So the training, transforming our minds is something extremely important, that our compassionate action to become real compassionate action, not driven by the self-centered mind. Very often, you know, initially motivated by the compassion. But then when time passes, when the project started, then become ego, self-centered, driven projects. Not to become that, it is really something helpful, important to transform our minds, thoughts, emotions in the early stage. You know, through that, then if we take actions, those actions will, you know, become real compassionate action, not driven by the self-centered. So this second stage, exchanging oneself with others. I usually say this, you know, if you look at it 24 hours, our body actions, speech, and the mental activities, very closely examine how many of these activities are purely, you know, dedicated for others without any self-interest, and how many of them are, you know, for the self-interest. If you closely examine, like me, very, very difficult to find really purely, you know, dedicated for others. You know, without looking that close, without looking very closely outside, it looks, you know, my compassionate project. It's really amazing, really dedicated to others. So the that a rigorous transformation, our thoughts, our emotions, are extremely helpful and useful, that our compassion, our actions and projects become real compassionate. So this one, the second step, exchanging oneself with others. That means, you know, that our present habits, driven by the self-centered mind, our present mental attitude, motivated by the self-centered mind, reduce them and replace them with the, you know, the mind thinking for others. And that's what here the meaning of exchange oneself with others. Then the third step is called taking and giving. Taking and giving in the meaning of, you know, the taking others' difficulties upon oneself and giving one's own virtues, merits, wholesomes, goodness to others. And that is the third step. Although initially, the third stage, all those, these three stages are very much mental level. But when the, you know, the transformation is, you know, successful or taken, genuinely taking place within ourselves, transformation of our thoughts, emotions, from the egoistic, self-centered to, you know, the altruistic, compassionate, these activities won't be just mental level, will be real, actual action, such as the taking and the giving. So the, in the, you know, the training, or, you know, the transforming the our present mental attitudes, our habits, which are very much, you know, consciously or subconsciously, you know, motivated, driven by the self-centered mind, is something extremely important to enhance the compassion that at the moment, at the present, in a form of seed, in a form of potential. Okay. How I'm doing, Peter, in terms of the time? Okay, yeah. So, now, as I briefly touched earlier, and this is something quite interesting to say, in Buddhism, the compassion and love is not same. It's different. Although the result, you know, at the end, end conclusion might be the same. But the experience of love and experience of compassion is different in Buddhism. Compassion is, you know, looking at the other living beings, other living creatures, and acknowledging their dukkha, their difficulties, then initially in a form of wishing, be free from the dukkha, and it can be slowly, you know, the enhanced. But love is, again, yes, looking at the other living creatures, but not looking at their dukkha, but looking at what's lacking for them. They're lacking the genuine happiness. So for the Buddhist practice, cultivation of love, that mind, is really looking at what's lacking for them, lacking the genuine happiness. Then, you know, love, cultivating love means you genuinely, sincerely have that wish that others to have that genuine love, which they are lacking. Compassion, on the other hand, here, what they have, which is dukkha, you genuinely, sincerely wish be free from dukkha. Although the essence and the product may be the same, but the mental outlook, the love and compassion are different. One is looking at what they have, and the initial wish be free from what they have, in terms of the compassion, in terms of the love, what they do not have, which is genuine happiness, and wishing them to have that happiness. So the, you know, the karuna, compassion, metta, love, in Sanskrit, love and compassion. In terms of the, you know, the cultivation of these two, which we should cultivate first, there's no fixed sequence. It is up to the individual from which angle you look at to the other living creatures. If you are looking at what they have, that dukkha, then you are looking at, you know, you are going from the cultivation of compassion. If you are looking from the what they do not have, what they are lacking, which is the genuine happiness, then you are approaching from the cultivation of love. Now, again, in Buddhism, there are three or four different compassions are explained. You know, saying the just saying the compassion, and the second one saying, immeasurable compassion, and third one is saying great compassion. You know, again, they all are compassion, but again have a slightly different, you know, the sort of, you know, the experience. The compassion in general, when we use the general term compassion, it is just simply looking, or you know, looking at other living beings. They are having difficulties and sincerely, genuinely wishing be free from those difficulties. That's just compassion. The second one, immeasurable compassion, in Jitsemet, in Tibetan. Immeasurable compassion, it is not just looking at a group of people or group of living creatures, but really vast numbers of living creatures. Vast numbers of living creatures. And that's called immeasurable compassion. Immeasurable in the sense of the focus is, you know, vast numbers of living creatures that you wish be free from dukkha. And the third, great compassion. Great compassion refers to that not just you have that kind of genuine, sincere wish, you know, those living creatures, be free from suffering and the origins of suffering, but you yourself take the responsibility that living creatures be free from dukkha. That's called the great compassion. So they all are compassion, but different sort of, you know, the levels that we can experience, that we can train, you know, transform our minds. So again, it's similar to the love, similar to the love. We can have it, you know, different levels of love that we can experience through the trainings. Me stop. Okay. So I'll do the short conclusion. Short conclusion. Conclusion is this: whether we have religious, any kind of faith, any kind of spiritual path, or not, you know, that being able to experience genuine compassion, individually, in the family level, in the community level, in the society level, is something extremely crucial, crucial in the sense of our well-being, individually, in the family, in the society. And to genuinely to experience compassion, you know, that cannot be, you know, bought from the supermarket, cannot be produced in the big factories. It is really up to individual. We have to put effort to make this, you know, the amazing mind to experience within ourselves, within the family, within society. And to do that, we don't have to have particular faith. You know, that kind of compassion can be experienced. Genuine compassion can be experienced without spiritual faith, without religion. You want to use this one?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
One, two.
Yes.
Thank you so much for that. It was a most wonderful description. And certainly it's going to repay playing in order to be able to understand the subtle distinctions that you're making. Right, questions?
Thank you for that great talk. Thank you very much. My name is Andreas. As far as I understand it, compassion is something we develop within us. How we apply it, though.
How?
Yeah. In certain circumstances, may be obvious. In other circumstances, we may need to have some knowledge and skill how to apply it properly. Because although we may have all the good wish to do something good, we may do something devastating.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
If you could comment on that, please. Thank you.
I mean, as I explained briefly, like this great Indian master who suggests following these three steps, three stages, you know, cultivating equanimity, exchanging oneself with others, These are the methods or the techniques that we can use. But also, it is also very helpful to, in a very objectively, to look at, to examine, you know, our sense of I, self, how we perceive that I or the self. That might be also another subject which I haven't touched, but might be helpful also to cultivate compassion.
May I assume that concretizing compassion into action is the point number four?
Yes, I agree. Yes.
Hello, sir. Don't forget your name.
Eric Abrams. Thank you for your earlier practical workshop as well. I'm intrigued by your last comment about well-being, because it's become a very politicized issue here in the West and certainly in Britain. And it's been linked very much to really health matters. But you're linking it to something much deeper and much more profound, which is actually about development of compassion. I wonder what your view would be of really the political attempt at well-being and what you would make of that.
Although I lived in this country for the last 17 years, I'm not really following the politics. And I do not have much comment on that. But well-being, even I'm sure politicians, you know, when they talk about, you know, their policy or whatever, I'm sure in the heart level they know well-being is not just materially we are well off. I'm sure they know that. They know well-being means also mentally, you know, that there's a sense of contentment, sense of, you know, the not too greedy, not to those, you know, the unhealthy mental states. I'm sure that they are able to think that, but when they are able to translate that into their policy or not, that's I don't know. Yeah.
Tashi, it's John Nightingale speaking. There is a little bit of confusion that I have here. You raise the question whether how many of our actions were really for the benefit of other people and how sometimes they could be benefit for one ourselves. But here there is a problem, because the only way you could be sure about that is if you were doing things to other people that were hurting yourself. Now that might be occasionally the right thing to do, but it sometimes might be a very destructive thing to do. You might become a masochist, and you actually see some people, there is a temptation to be like that, out of eagerness to do good things to other people, not to do it for yourself, and after all, there is also compassion for your oneself. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that particular problem.
From the Buddhist point of view, what is important is the beginning, which is the intention, pure intention, and at the end, which is the result. The main action, the main activity, although it's very important, but the most important are those two, the intention and the end result. The main action can sometimes be quite disturbing, quite difficult, but the initial intention and the end product, if these two are positive, then you have to, you know, judge as a positive. Is that you're asking? Because I have, you know, as I said, although I lived in this country last 17 years, I still haven't managed to master this language. So I have a great difficulty. Yes.
It helps a bit.
Okay.
But it would still be possible for there to be a confusion in the original intention.
Mm.
You might be wanting to intend good for other people, but you might also be wanting at the same time to be, in a funny way, intending bad for yourself.
Yeah, that was I was talking about earlier, that, you know, the initially paying close attention to transforming one's own mind will be the solution, the intention not be mixture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Julian Candy.
Yeah.
Hello. The word empathy appears in the title of this conference.
Yes.
I wonder if I could ask what the Buddhist view about that might be.
Okay.
Because, I mean, my general understanding in a simple sense is that when one's empathetic, one is actually able to sense what it is like to be the other person, even in a rather incomplete and partial way.
Mm.
But of course the danger of that, and maybe this is where it links with just the previous question, the danger is that in fact you're mistaken about that and you're not actually empathizing, but you think you are. I wonder if the Buddhist tradition has something to say about that.
As in the previous session, there was a little bit discussion about, you know, the when the term is start or not, and so on and so forth. Empathy is English term. It's not Sanskrit. It's not Tibetan. So I cannot comment on that much. But what I will comment is this, on Karuna, which is Sanskrit, and Nyingje, which is in Tibetan. In these two terms, you know, the both terms, particularly the Nyingje, which Tibetan, which I know a little bit better than the Sanskrit, definitely have a connotation of, you know, the acknowledgement of that other's difficulties. Nyingje. But it depends on, you know, the acknowledgement, full acknowledgement or partial acknowledgement, that very much depends on your capability. But the term, the Nyingje, has that kind of connotation.
Of entering into the life of the other person.
Yes, you can say that.
Yes, yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah. So how do you distinguish what's correct, whether you're doing it right or whether you're mistaken?
I just commented earlier. It says that it depends, it dependent on initial motivation and the end product.
Yeah. Yes, okay.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Paul Entwistle. My question, I think, follows on from the question of Mr. Abrahams. If some recent prominent British politicians were here, I think they'd wish to be tough on dukkha and tough on the causes of dukkha. And you say you've been here for 17 years.
Yeah.
I would just like to ask you if you perceive certain traits in our society which perhaps lead to more difficulties in the West than you would have in the East.
Mm. I think one thing what I have noticed is in the education field, the education is very much focused on literacy, numeracy. Not very much as a, you know, producing a good human being. That's what I noticed, that, you know, when they talk about educating our, you know, the offsprings, the children, mainly talking about how to, you know, the get good marks on their writing and their, you know, their math. Not very much their, you know, their warm-heartedness, that, you know, they're able to consider other children, other, you know, schoolmates, their well-being. That part is lacking. That's what I've noticed. I'm not saying in the East they have that, but in general, that's what I've.
Okay, this has to be the last question, I think. Who's got the microphone up there? Yes, okay, last question.
Jane Whistler. I was looking at intention and the result.
Yeah.
And so back to the earlier discussion, really, because sometimes if the person has suffered, they can be confused when somebody else is asking for something. And in order to avoid giving suffering, they often, with intention to avoid it, therefore feeling compassionate, make a decision that leads to not the best result, because they can't face discussing in depth the real situation at the time they're trying to be compassionate. And so sometimes I can see the beginning and the middle can be a very long struggle,
yes,
but the result cannot bear fruit in the way intended.
Yes, yes.
And I'd just like you to comment on that.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah.
Well, Tashi, it's been a wonderful afternoon. I was fortunate because I heard both halves of it. And your description of compassion, I think, is absolutely outstanding. I can see you standing in your Tibetan monastery having these long, long erudite discussions. And it must have been a wonderful time for you. Thank you also for the description of the difference between love, something you're lacking, and suffering, something which is given. I felt that to be a really, really wonderful distinction. But most of all, I thank you very much for your comment that compassion is not something which you buy in a supermarket. It doesn't come over the shelf. In fact, what it does mean is that we all have to work hard on ourselves. First of all, to understand what true compassion is, and then the second stage, to practice it. So thank you very much indeed for coming here. We're really sorry that you have to go, but we're so delighted that you've been able to spare us your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Really.